Okay. Office hours, just a reminder that you need to attend at least one session of office hours in the first 3 weeks, and we'll have a sign-up sheet there, and we'll send out information about office hours. The first one, I think, is going to be on this Sunday, and we'll send out information. And also, I handed out on Monday a course survey. If you didn't hand in the course survey, please make sure to turn that in today by 3 p.m. We have our TA meeting at 3:30 p.m., and we look through those to get a little bit of a sense about who's in the class and what the mixture is so that we can tune that. If you didn't get a course survey, they are on the website, which won't help you a whole lot right now. If you can't turn it in on time, then please still turn it in because it is useful to us. Okay, does anybody not have copies of the lecture notes? Raise your hand. Okay, what we'll try and do is I'll try and leave them in the back of the lecture hall, and I'll try and make sure they get here before people start streaming in. So please remember to pick up a copy, and you should all have mud carts in front of you. Okay, so what I want to do in today's lecture is, now this is more or less the CDS 110 students, and so I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about some of the CDS 110 types of things, and still an overview kind of intro type of lecture. We're not going to get into some of the more technical details until next week, but I want to talk a little bit more about the modern engineering environment for control and some of the applications of control, and then give a little bit of additional detail for CDS 110, and then I want to reserve some time at the end to talk about the honor system and how it applies to this class. And the reading is the same as it was for Monday and for the whole week, which is just out of chapter 1 of the course text. Okay, so on Monday, we talked about this idea that control is sensing, computation, and actuation in a feedback loop. And we gave this example of cruise control and talked about some of the goals of a control system as being stability. I want the system to maintain a desired operating point, and for example, holding a steady speed, performance, that I respond quickly or as desired to changes, and robustness, that as the system changes underneath me, for example, the parameters describing this vehicle might change, that the control system continues to provide both stability and performance under those changes. But we can dive in a little bit more and sort of say, well, yeah, but how is this done? And so in most of the control systems that we deal with these days, this is done via computer control. We can break things out a little bit differently. We've got our system that's still here. We have the sensors and the actuators. We then take the output of the system as it comes from the sensors and measure that inside the controller. And so that measurement will often be done via an analog to digital conversion. So we'll take an analog signal, like a voltage coming off of something that's telling us about the speed or temperature or whatever it happens to be. We will take that analog signal, convert it to a digital signal, so basically digitize it. It's a number now, a binary number between 0 and 5, or 0 to 5 volts, a floating point number, something like that. And now once we have it in digital form, then inside the computer, we'll implement all of the control algorithms and other things. And so every hundredth of a second, perhaps, you will look at what are the values of the output of the process and decide what you want to command as your actuation variables. And so that is still a digital signal. And so we'll go from a digital to analog representation. So in particular, a digital analog converter will take that digital representation and convert it back into a voltage or a current or some physical variable that we can send to the system that then goes into the actuator. So if this is a motor, for example, this might be the voltage that is controlling the amount of current going across that motor, or controlling an amplifier that's connected to that motor. And so we'll normally kind of ignore the analog to digital and digital analog conversions on the ends, but when you implement a control system, and if you do the course project in CDS 110B, you'll see this, then you have to explicitly do those conversions someplace and get things into the right units. And this is, even itself, of course, very simplified. We often have filters and other things that are also there. So we'll usually talk about the process as being the combination of the system and the sensors and the actuators. And we'll talk about the controller as being the computer and the A to D hardware on the side of it. The other things that are important on this diagram is some of the disturbances that can enter in. And so first we can have external disturbances that act directly on the system. And this might be in the context of, say, the power grid, if that's the system that you're looking at. The external disturbances are people turning on and off the lights or turning on a big machine someplace. If it's the internet, the external disturbances are the amount of load from different people clicking on web pages and other things. And so these are things that are not under your control. As a designer, you can't control what the power usage on the power grid is going to be if you're designing a generator. They're simply something external that comes in that you have to react to. And so that's one type of uncertainty that can enter our system, is the uncertainty of what the outside world does to us. Another type of uncertainty is that whenever you take a measurement, then of course you can have measurement noise, and that measurement noise shows up at the output. And so I have the actual value that I sense. I then, let's say, have a voltage that comes out, but that voltage goes through a wire, perhaps, that finally comes back to a board that's going to have all of these components, and across that wire I might get noise. And so if I'm going exactly some speed, and that's getting converted to a voltage that tells me the speed, then I might see that thing wiggle around a little bit from the noise, let's say, in the automobile of the other electronics and other things. And so your output is not really the output, it's the output plus this noise. So it's the actual output plus the noise. And similarly, when you command an input to these actuators, you can get noise added on here. And so all of these disturbances matter because you're somehow trying to react to certain things. So for example, if there's an external disturbance, which is I'm going up a hill, then I'd like to react to that external disturbance. I'd like my control system to compensate for that. But if there's an external noise that's just that some noise came in and my speed was a little bit off, then somehow I don't want to react to that, right? So for example, a typical thing would be that I might have some high frequency noise at 100 hertz, my speed's bouncing around a little bit, right? But I don't want to try and react to that and try and have at 100 times a second the car adjusting its speed, right? Trying to follow that noisy signal, right? Or to cancel out that noisy signal. And so a big part of control system design is understanding how to compensate for all of these. And as we go through the course, we'll learn how to do that. All right, so let's kind of go in and look at what might happen inside this computer and look at an example of a control law. And so this is going to be the diagram that we use for the term, in some sense. We have the process here, and we'll talk about what some of these symbols mean in a second. We have the disturbance, the external disturbances coming in here. I've left off the noise in this case, and I've taken the special case where the external disturbances come in at the same place as the input. So this is a block that represents the input signal coming into our process and the output signal they measure. This has both the sensing and actuation in it, and here I have a disturbance that I've modeled as coming in at the same place as my process input. So it's a simplification, but still useful. That then, of course, feeds back. A typical thing that I do is I want the output of my system to track a reference. And so this is often called a unity gain feedback system. This little symbol here is a summation, and there's a little minus sign in front of this arrow. And so I've got an arrow coming in here, R, for the reference. I've got an arrow coming in here, Y, and I've got a minus sign. And the output of this little plus circle with a plus sign in it, man, it's noisy out there, is the error, and that error is exactly the reference minus the actual. And so if that error is zero, then my controller doesn't need to do anything. But if that error is non-zero, right, then my controller should compensate for it. And so my controller then is this block here, and it generates some input, and again, the disturbances get added on. And very typically, I might have my process dynamics described by an ordinary differential equation, and we'll talk a lot about these in the next couple of weeks. But you can just think of this as some description of how the system evolves. And so I have some state of the system. This might be the various parameters that describe the engine, how much fuel is going in it, and other things that change as a function of time and the speed of the vehicle and other parameters. And I write that as some differential equation affected by my inputs. And then I have whatever I measure, which is some combination of my state and my outputs. And again, we're going to go into this in a lot more detail. But this is the typical type of thing that one might see. Now, for this controller then, we can look at different ways of deciding what should the input to the process U be as a function of the error. And the simplest thing you can imagine, the example that we used from Monday, is that U might just be this first term here, Kp times E. Right? And in fact, if you go back and look at Monday's notes, you'll see that's exactly what we did. We did Kp times the reference minus the actual speed for our cruise controller, and that is called a proportional controller. But we can also add other terms. So a proportional controller will react to the error that I have right now. Right? And so if I have some amount of error, I'll produce some amount of control action. So think about what happens if I am driving along just fine with zero error, right? And I have no input that's required. So suppose that I've trimmed my input so that if I put U equal to zero, that provides exactly the amount of gas that I need to drive at some speed. And now suppose I start going up a hill. As I go up the hill, I slow down, so I create some error, right? If I create some error, then E grows a little bit, and then my U grows. I apply some more gas, right? But as I apply that gas, right, will I ever make the error be zero? Well, I won't, right? Because if the error is zero, I'll stop applying the gas, right? And so you'll always have a little bit of error, right? Exactly the amount of error that's required to generate an input, right, that holds that error constant, right? And so in these proportional controllers, and we'll sort of go through and see this in detail, but just intuitively, a proportional controller only applies a force when there's some error. And so if you have a disturbance like a hill, then you're always going to have some error. And you might not like that, right? So if you just brought, you know, a brand new $50,000 car, right, and you head up the Tujunga Pass, right, up going up to Santa Barbara, and you go up that hill, and all of a sudden you're commanding 75 and your car's only going 70, right? You go, come on, you know, I just paid $50,000 for this car, right? It should be able to go up this at the right speed. So one of the ways that you can compensate for that is to use what's called integral feedback or integral action. And the idea is to say, look, if I'm going up a hill and I have had this error for the last 10 seconds, I clearly am not applying enough input. And so I ought to apply a little bit more. I ought to look back in time, right, and use some of my past error to determine what some of my current input is. Integral terms do that. What an integral term does is it looks at the integral of the past error from zero, the time I started my controller, until the current time, and it takes that error and multiplies it times a gain. So now think about what happens when I head up a hill. Right? If I head up a hill, I start to slow down a bit, E is going to be some positive number because R is going to be bigger than Y. If E is some positive number, right, then I'm integrating a positive number. What's happening to this integral term is it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. That means I'm going to apply more and more input, right? When is it going to stop? It's going to stop when I get to a situation where my error goes back to zero, right? If my error is not zero, I'm going to keep applying more and more input. So an integral term, right, the error can be zero, but the integral doesn't have to be zero. The integral is the integral of the past error. So my instantaneous error might be zero, but I'm still applying some input from whatever my integrator built up over the past time. So this is a way to compensate for constant disturbances. It allows me to provide exactly the amount of input. Sometimes it's called an auto-bias term, for example. It sets the bias, the amount of nominal input you need. So an integral term is something that you often find yourself using when it really matters that you track that thing exactly. And all of the cruise control systems that you have in your cars have an integral term or something like them. Now, another thing that can happen is that you can say, well, that's good. I'm looking back in time. But you also want to think maybe a little bit about looking forward in time. That is, if I'm coming up across the top of a hill, then I see that my error starts to change, right? I've come up across the top of the hill. As my error changes, I really want to back off of the gas a little bit, maybe even predicting a little bit. I see that I'm starting to speed up, and so rather than waiting until my error gets big, maybe I want to react to that change in my error. And so you can do that as well, and that's called a derivative term. And so if I look at the derivative of the error with respect to time, then I can multiply that by some gain. This type of a controller is called a three-term controller. Originally it was called a three-term controller. It's now called a PID controller, proportional integral derivative. It's by far the most common type of controller that people use. And even if you're designing a control system and not using PID explicitly, these ideas of having integral action and some sort of an anticipatory effect are very common. So, for example, in biological systems, we'll often see anticipatory terms. We'll often see integral terms. Integral term is called perfect adaptation in biology, right? So it allows you to adapt the system parameters such that you cancel out constant biases. All right, so these types of controllers are what we want to study. So the question that we want to answer in this class is, suppose I take this calculation and I put it inside my controller. How am I going to do that in the context of, say, a computer implementation? Well, I can write down U, I can calculate the error, that's easy enough. I have my reference, right? So if we look back at the previous chart, I've got my operator input, that's going to be my reference. I've got my output that I measure here, that's going to be Y. And so from that I can calculate out the error and I can calculate this term. I can not integrate in a continuous way, but if I sample, right, at 100 hertz, I can approximate this integral by the error at every hundredth hertz, or at every hundredth of a second, and then multiply it times delta t, right? So approximate this integral by a sum. And I can take the derivative by looking at the error now versus the error one time step ago, right, and dividing by the time interval between those, and that'll give me an approximation. And so we can implement a PID controller fairly simply via these techniques. And of course, there's other things we would do. But once we've done that, we can say, okay, is the system stable? Does it have good performance? And is it robust? And what are the choices that we get to make as a designer in this type of a control law? We get to choose KP, KI, and KD. So those are three numbers that we choose. And the question is, how do I choose those numbers such that I get solutions that converge to an equilibrium point, that is, that they maintain a steady operating point, that I get good tracking of my reference so that as I go up the hill, for example, my reference is a constant there. I don't want to dip down for a long time and slowly speed back up. I really want to hold that reference speed very precisely and very quickly. And I'd also like that that works if I have disturbances, noise that might be entering in, other unmodeled disturbances, wind gusts and other things, as well as uncertainty in my model. So I'm building this based on some model of my system, and maybe I don't quite have the dynamics right. I'd like to know that the system still works. All right, so this is the type of thing that we're going to do in the first term of this class. And in particular, we're going to look at lots of different techniques for analyzing these types of systems and designing not only KP, KI, and KD, but more general forms of control laws and understanding how those work. Now, sort of this is a typical way in which one designs a control system. But modern control systems, the role of feedback is getting more interesting. So here's, if you want a little bit fancier cruise control system, this is an autonomous vehicle. This is, if you haven't heard about it, this is Alice. It is a Ford E350 van designed and built here at Caltech to be an autonomous vehicle. It is, as we speak, getting ready for its next competition. But this picture is from 2005 when Alice competed in the 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge, which was an autonomous road race across the desert. And at a high level, this is all just a big feedback problem, a control design problem. This is what the architecture looks like for how Alice works. So let me walk through it a little bit so that you get a sense of both how you design a system like this and where some of the principles that we learn in this class apply and where some of the other things that we learn a little bit later on in CDS apply. So we start with the vehicle. This is the process that we have. This is the actuation for that process, right? So that's the system. That's the actuation. The actuation for Alice is that we have a motor on the steering wheel. We can shift back and forth. We can press the gas and the brakes. We can turn the turn signals on. Those are all the actuators. We sense the position of the vehicle with something called a state estimator. We're going to talk about state estimators in CDS 110B, but the idea is by measuring the GPS position of the vehicle as well as the acceleration and angular rates of the vehicle, we can tell where the vehicle is at any given point in time. So that's our output measurements. So think of this as being some combination of the raw sensors, GPS, inertial measurement unit, with some algorithm on it. But this is roughly the sensing block. And path follower is the control law. And in fact, the path follower is two PID control loops in this system. Right? So exactly what I just showed you. And so this loop right here is precisely the sort of thing that we're going to study and try and do well. Now, what about the rest of all of this stuff over here? Well, you don't just want to, given some path, follow that path. You have to figure out what that path is. For an autonomous vehicle driving all by itself in the desert, right, the task we're given is drive from here to 5 miles from here and don't run into anything in the meantime. And we're not given a description of exactly how we should go. We're simply told, look, you know, look around. Don't drive over bushes. Drive on roads if you see them. Figure out what to do. So how do we do that in Alice? Well, what we do is we have a bunch of environmental sensors, and those environmental sensors, you can see in the picture, there are cameras. There are four cameras here and a fifth one up here. There are laser rangefinders. There's one down in the bumper here. There's another one sitting here, and there are two more, one here, and actually three more, one here, and one here. A laser rangefinder just scans in front of it and tells you the distance to whatever the laser beam hits. So you can think of it as telling you the distance to the ground, for example, or if there's a bush in the way, it'll tell you that there's something closer that's higher up in the air. And all of those sensors are used in Alice to develop an elevation map. So that elevation map is roughly what is the elevation of the ground in front of me out over the next 50 meters or so. And from that elevation map, we can then try and figure out where to drive. And the where to drive part is that we'd like to drive, this is a race in the case of the DARPA Grand Challenge, it was the fastest vehicle to drive 150 miles in 10 hours or less, and so we want to drive in places where we can go fast. And so you can go fast when it's flat, and so essentially what you do is you say, in areas where it's flat, those are good places to drive. And so the way that we deal with that is we take that elevation map, which just gives us the raw elevation, and we look for areas in which it's flat, and we associate those areas with low cost, and we associate areas that are very bumpy with higher cost, and we associate areas that have vertical inclines, which are obstacles, right? If there's a vertical change in height, that's an obstacle, with very high cost. And that gives us a cost map that is out in front of us. I can see where is it low cost, that means I can go at high speed to drive, where is it high cost? And I can use that cost map to then plan a path, to find some path that actually goes through. And so this path planning problem, we'll study this in CDS-110B, and we'll call this the trajectory generation problem. And you should think of this as generating the reference input. So we actually want to generate the reference input. It's not going to be given to us by somebody with a dial saying, here's where I want you to drive, or a human saying, here's where I want. The computer is going to actually generate the path based on the lowest cost way to get from here to there. And again, lowest cost means highest speed. In addition to the environmental sensors, we also had some road finding sensors. These are sensors that are designed to look for areas that look like roads. So what does a road look like? If you have a camera, one thing a road looks like is you see a bunch of lines that are pointing toward a single vanishing point. So if you see a bunch of parallel lines, right, which are your road edges and your curbs and maybe lane tracks on the ground, all pointing towards something, you say that's highly likely a road. And so what we can do is we can look for those roads, and then in the cost map, we can bump down the cost in those regions so that we want to drive in regions where there are roads. And so that's the way we design something for a system like this. All right, so all of this is really just a big control system, and there are lots of feedback loops. So we already talked about the feedback loop that's in here. But there are also feedback loops, for example, through the environment. So the environment is what? It's all of the ground around us. It's the sun location. It's the types of bushes that are there, as well as the elevation of terrain, other vehicles that might be in the way. All of those things can affect our system. So, for example, if I start going over bumpy roads, then all of a sudden I'm bouncing around a lot, and that's going to affect where I think my vehicle is. If I don't have a good way of taking out all of those bumpy things, for example, that might happen. And it's a feedback loop because where I decided to drive will affect how bumpy it was, right? So there's an interconnection there. So for example, you could get to something where as I start to drive on something bumpy, I get confused and I start to more and more drive on bumpy things. That would be a bad feedback interconnection, right? It'd be kind of unstable. We also have feedback because as we drive around, what we see changes. And as I turn, for example, then I lose sight of something. I might lose sight of a road, or I might see something from a different angle. And so all of that feeds back through these different paths into this overall system. And I've sort of drawn it here as if these are the only feedback loops, but in fact there are many, many more that we simply don't draw on this. And all of these feedback loops can cause problems with stability, can cause performance issues, and can have robustness issues. And so we want to study all of those. And just to say, we're looking at mainly this loop, this term, and it's something that you can put onto a single small microprocessor that you can buy for $10. As you start to get to these higher and higher level control loops and reasoning at kind of higher levels of abstraction, you use more and more computation. So in the version that was shown here, we were using six sort of servers running Linux, that these are pretty high-end servers, as well as a high-end computing engine that was itself as fast as all six of these computers. So we're using about a dozen computers to compute all of this connected together across the internet. And so the design of that is rather interesting. So in CDS-110A, we'll focus quite a lot on this loop. In CDS-110B, we'll talk about state estimators, which come in both here as well as over here. And we'll also talk about trajectory generation and optimal trajectory generation, that is minimizing some cost function. So by the time we get done with CDS-110A and B, we will effectively have covered all of this diagram. We won't talk a lot about the road finding end, and we won't talk some about the sensor processing at the lower level. That's for other classes here at Caltech. Right. So that's kind of the thing we want to do. All right, so that's what now a really modern control system looks like. How are we going to attack these things and how are we going to look at them? So if you go out and look in the literature on control, you'll find there are kind of two broad approaches to looking at control system design. One is what are called black box methods. So what I do is that I have some inputs that I know about, some outputs that I know about, and I have very little knowledge about what connects those two things together, what's inside the system. But I still want to control it. And so I might, for example, do something by learning. I might do something about learning by observation. I try applying the input at this value, I see what happens. I try applying a different input, I see what happens. And if I can learn what's going on in that system, then I can use my knowledge of that just at the kind of input-output level without any description of the details to design a controller. And so examples of techniques that use more or less this flavor, so auto-tuning regulators are one. That is that I don't care about what's inside. I just, for example, apply a step input, watch the step input, and use that to tune my gains, my for example, proportional gain, integral gain, and derivative gain. And auto-tuning PID controllers are a big industry. There are lots of these things around. Adaptive neural networks are another one. So I have a neural network description of my box, and I try and update the weights on that neural network such that they give me a description of either the process, and then I can control that neural network process, or I can have a neural network that is the controller and adapt the weights directly on the controller, try and get a neural network that controls the system. Fuzzy logic is another one, and I won't talk a lot about fuzzy logic, but if you're interested, ask me about it, and I'll point you at some references. All right, so why might you want to do these types of things? Well, they're great when you don't have a detailed model of what's going on underneath. And so, or where the performance specifications don't require that sort of a detailed model. Great example is there are lots of feedback systems now running on washing machines, right? So writing down the dynamics of how your clothes get clean, right, would require, if you really wanted to do it, right, it's, you know, how does the fluid flow right through a complicated set of clothes and mix with soap and take dirt off and all of these things? It's a washing machine, all right? You really don't need to do this, all right? And so typically you use a much simpler technique than that. One of the problems with that is that there are no formal tools for going and asking some types of questions. So if I ask you, you know, can I prove that your washing machine will never, right, tear your shirt, right, or will never make your colors fade in the way you want, or, you know, turn your underwear red or whatever it is, right, a proof of that is not an easy thing to come by, right? Because you don't have a model, right, if you're doing these black box methods that does that. Sometimes you want that and sometimes you don't. Your washing machine, you're probably okay with it, right? Just don't mix colors and whites and you're good. It also doesn't work so well for high-performance systems, right? And so if I have something where it really does need to do the right thing, auto-land systems in airplanes, you would probably like to know as a passenger, right, that somebody has gone and proved that if the wind is less than 20 knots and, right, you're landing with, you know, a runway that's 10 meters wide, that you'll actually land on the runway and not crash the plane, right? So you'd probably like to have a formal proof of that or believe that an engineer someplace, maybe one of you someday, right, has actually gone and made sure it worked. Not just sort of say, well, let's try it, right? You know, people stop buying planes that crash a lot, you know, and so, you know, we'll eventually figure it out, right? Washing machines, you can do that. Airplanes, you probably can't. All right, so the other technique, the other class of techniques are model-based methods, and these are, of course, the ones where we build up a detailed model of what's going on inside the process and then try and use that detailed model in the design of our controller. And so the detailed model might be ordinary differential equations. We'll talk a lot about those. Partial differential equations, we'll touch on them only briefly. Discrete equations, so difference equations, we'll talk a little bit about those. And then the control techniques that go along with those. And so optimal regulators, H-infinity control, H1 control, H2 control, feedback linearization, these are all techniques that we'll touch on a little bit in this class, some more than others. So these systems work great when you have something that is complicated and you need to have a model of that complication to sort of sort out what's going on, right? It's not like you just look at the inputs and the outputs and kind of figure out a good control. I really need to understand the details of those dynamics. And there are rigorous tools for investigating the robustness and performance of at least some of these systems, so some classes of systems. For example, linear systems or even nonlinear systems that are finite dimensional ordinary differential equations, etc., we can do that for. So the good news is that they work well for complicated systems, and we really can prove stuff about them. So we really can prove, for example, you'll land on the runway, even for something as complicated as an aircraft. The bad news is that the tools don't work for everything. And so, in fact, there are limited classes of systems in which we can apply those tools. And the other is that the modeling part of this is hard. In fact, usually I'll tell you that if you're a control engineer, you're going to spend 95% of your time modeling and 5% of your time designing the control law. Because designing a control law, you take the tools that we learn in this class and you apply them, right? The trick is to get a model that has the relevant physics or biology or chemistry or information flow in it so that you can apply the tools and solve the right problem. And so modeling turns out to be, in kind of control-oriented modeling, turns out to be the hard part of the problem. So in this class, we're primarily going to focus on this set of techniques. But again, you want to ask yourself, if somebody says, please come and design a control system for me, try and understand a little bit about what really is the control problem, what's the system, what are the performance specifications, and maybe you can get away with a black box method, or maybe you really have to go to these model-based methods. These are expensive, complicated, take a long time to get right, but you can certify them, you can verify them, and you can do other things, right? And you have to decide whether or not those are important for you. Okay, so what I want to do next is, having sort of just said a little bit about some of the types of things we're going to learn and some of the methodologies, I want to give a little bit of an overview of the field at the start of the class. All right? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through some material that's part of a report. It looks like this. So this is a little book that a panel of people put together called Control in an Information-Rich World. There are copies of this sitting outside my office. And if you are interested in learning a little bit more about control theory and where it's going, it's about 2 years old now, maybe three, and the copies are there for you to take. So grab one if you're interested. And I would just want to give you a little bit of an overview of some of what's in there. And so one of the things that's in there is sort of looking back a little bit. We're mainly looking forward, but looking back a little bit and saying, where did control come from? And so there's lots of really interesting history of control. I have in my office, if anybody's interested, you can come by and look at it sometime, a Scientific American article. This is from the cover of the Scientific American article, where the entire issue is on control from 1952. And there's some great things in it. So they define, right, to control, right? They define the article to be about control of all things that are self-regulating or capable of self-regulation. So they like this self-regulating. They talk about the main principle of control being feedback, and they have this wonderful quote that I like: "Control will liberate man." You can tell when it was written. "Control will liberate man from the routine tasks of mere survival." Right. So I think that's pretty good, right? You know, this is a reasonable reason to get into this particular field, right? It's because you're going to liberate people from the routine tasks of mere survival. Right? And in fact, if you read it, they were a little bit worried, right, that control systems were suddenly going to put everybody out of work and we wouldn't be able to do anything, it would be automated, right, all of these things. And of course, that hasn't happened. About that same time, though, there were control systems that were coming out, that were available, that people were seeing. One of the very simplest one is a thermostat, like you see on the wall. These don't exist in very many places anymore, but if you work for the government, you'll see some of those. They seem to keep them around for a while. So this is a Honeywell thermostat. The T86 and the T87 came out in about the 1950s, and they were some of the first systems to try and regulate temperature in buildings using control techniques. And, you know, it looks like a simple device, but inside it's got all of the types of things that we're talking about, all implemented via little mercury switches and other springs and other mechanical things to get those to work. Another example is cruise control. So the first commercially available cruise control system was the Chrysler Autopilot, introduced in 1958. On the Chrysler Imperial, right, sort of top-end car. This is a diagram of the autopilot system. And if you look in here, right, there is the flyball governor. All right, so that's really what it was. If you want to see a flyball governor, you can look back at George, who will show you his flyball governor. So this is a flyball governor, and if it spins, all right, so you see it come up a little bit, and if he slows down, sort of comes up and down. There it goes. All right, so it goes up and down. So that was sitting inside your car, right, connected to the drive shaft. Right, not quite as big as that one, I think. But that was actually the first one. It was a mechanical thing. And if you go through and you trace it, right, what it does is it adjusts a spring that controls the throttle and does all of these other interesting things. Probably the kind of revolution in control as a field came as people started to look in flight controls. So flight controls was an area where they wanted high-performance systems, and control was one of the ways of doing that. And so the F-18 was one of the first fly-by-wire aircraft. What fly-by-wire means is there's no mechanical linkages between the pilot's controls and any of the actuators, right? It's all just going to some electronic system or a computer, so the pilot is more or less, right, just telling the computer, this is what I want to do. I like to turn the plane this way or turn the plane that way. And a feedback control system, that's a reference input, and a feedback control system is then actually via control law doing that. One of the interesting things that happens in systems systems like this is that you don't want those systems to fail, and so you don't want that because your computer happened to crash, right, that your plane happens to crash. And so in these types of systems, and in modern aircraft today, they use redundant systems, so they'll actually have three or four different computers, and different I don't just mean three or four, whoops, I was here. Three or four of the same computer, right? They'll actually use different types of microprocessors, right? So if there's a glitch someplace, right, in the floating point unit on this, that, or the other, right, maybe one or two of the processors will fail under that glitch, but not all of them. They also would often use different software. So one might be programmed in C++ and another one in Java, right, just to make sure that if there was some kind of standard bug that people might use, that didn't happen. And they would do it with different design teams. And so, in fact, you wouldn't have one group, right, make the same bug in four different languages on, right, you know, four different types of computers, but rather have different design teams that would go through and design them from the specification, right? And so the idea was that now I've got four different implementations, and now I have to vote on what to do, right? And so you would check, and if three of the four said to do one thing, you would do that one, and you would vote the other one out. Okay, so we'll see whether or not we get our screen back. Doesn't look good. Hello. Lectern center, select the screen. All right, there we go. Okay, good. All right. So in this book, it talks not only about some of these early things, but also where things are going. And so I'm going to go through those relatively quickly, but you're welcome to read the book if you want more. I should also say that the book's available online. If I didn't, I'll put a link on the webpage for the course. And so if you just want to kind of read a part of it or whatever and not pick up the hard copy, you're welcome to. Okay, so in the book we look at different areas, and so I'll just go through some of these briefly. In the area of transportation and aerospace, if you say, fine, we can get planes to fly, right? They work pretty well. But where are things going? And where things are going is really looking at autonomous system, looking at systems where all of the aircraft in the air or all of the cars on the ground can talk to different types of resources all the time, so that your car can see what the traffic patterns are in the next 5 miles ahead of you and maybe do something about that. Ultra-reliable systems in transportation and aerospace. Transportation is often transportation of people, and we want that systems that are transporting people are safe. We see a lot of ultra-reliability requirements and other things. Lots of different disciplines have to come together, from computer science to electrical engineering to mechanical engineering, aeronautics, all of these different fields to make something like an airplane or a car or any of those sorts of transportation and aerospace systems have to come together. And the types of modeling we have to do, in fact, what we're going to learn about in this class are models of this form, and one of the things that we need to do is move beyond models just of that form, right? And so already, the things that we're learning here, we're seeing that they aren't enough to solve these problems. What are the types of things that we want to do? Well, here's a picture of the air traffic control network around San Francisco, right? And if you go look now, you can go on the web and look at these real-time networks. There are thousands of planes in the air all at once, and they're all trying to get to different places and trying not to run into each other, and they're all getting coupled together, because if I go this way, then that gives more space for another plane, so it can start to move, but that may cramp another plane. So how do we design air traffic control systems that are robust to things like thunderstorms in Chicago? Right? That's the disturbance that you would like. You'd like that if I'm not flying to Chicago, right, it shouldn't affect me, right? But we all know that if there's a big thunderstorm or snowstorm in Chicago, right, the entire air transportation system can shut down. How do we stop things like that from happening? So in transportation and aerospace, a lot of these very interesting questions. And again, how do you do that in an ultra-reliable way? In the area of information and networks, this includes things like control of the internet, control of the power grid. The internet's a great example. It's probably the largest man-made control system on Earth. So every time your computer sends a packet someplace, there's actually a little control system in it that's regulating the rate at which you send those packets. And if the network's congested, you don't want everybody to just keep sending things at full rate, because then you're not going to ever get anything through, right? It's going to get worse, because you're going to be resending data trying to get it through, and everybody starts to resend, and you get this big collapse. So what do? You have a window that says how much data will I send before I wait, and that window, all right, is actually controlled by a feedback system, right? And the feedback system is a particular TCP transmission control protocol, or congestion control protocol sometimes called. In your computers, you'll use something like Reno, which is a specific congestion control protocol, and it will modulate that window size to try and maintain the overall throughput of the network. And so there's a lot of interesting work and a lot of it going on here actually in this building with Stephen Lowe's group. So Stephen Lowe is a professor in computer science and electrical engineering who's really looking at how do we do better on congestion control. And he has a protocol and a new company called FAST for the protocol and FastSoft for the company that really are how do you do better control of the internet at the congestion control level. Similarly, the power grid and how do you modulate things, all of these are good examples of control of and over networks. So if you have an information system, there's often a network involved with that information system. You can look at how do you control the network itself, for example, packets going through the network, but you can also look at how do you do control over that network. If packets are what I'm sending, then those get to be interesting. In the area of robotics and intelligent machines, lots of stuff happening. It's a very exciting time. The DARPA Grand Challenge is something that we've participated in here. The goal of the DARPA Grand Challenge is to implement systems of capable of exhibiting highly flexible or intelligent responses to changing circumstances, basically do what humans seem to do very well. What's interesting about that is that if you look back to Wiener, who was a professor at MIT and started a field called cybernetics, right, that was pretty much exactly his goal as well. Right? So over 50 years, right, we're still working on this, but things are starting to happen. Now we're starting to see cars that can drive themselves around in urban environments, so that's the particular challenge of the next DARPA Grand Challenge, can drive themselves across the desert. Stanford drove 131 miles across the desert in 6 hours completely autonomously, right? Finding roads, figuring out where to drive, driving at quite high speeds. Really amazing what's going on in these types of fields. And of course, JPL and others are putting autonomous machines on other planets and letting them roam around, and the amount of human involvement is now somewhat high. We'd like to make that less as we go forward. Biology and medicine is another area where there are great strides happening. I am missing right now because I'm teaching the International Conference on Systems Biology in Long Beach, and the ICSB is an example of the community coming together and starting to say, how do we apply systems thinking and ideas from control systems and other areas to biological systems? And so what's happening is we're now getting to the point where we understand the component level descriptions of what's going on in biological systems better and better, but what's missing is our understanding of how a large collection of these components work together to do something. So what is cancer and how does cancer happen? It's a network of individual interactions in different ways and the cell trying to fight it off and then other things hijacking the cell's mechanisms for dying and replicating and other things. And so understanding of those will certainly require, among other things, an understanding of the feedback interconnections of those systems. One of the things that's also exciting that's happening, and some of the people in my group work on this, is looking at design of biological systems. That we're now at the point where you can specify a sequence of DNA, put that sequence on a computer, send it to a company that will send you back the DNA with that sequence. You can then embed that sequence of DNA into a cell and use that to express a circuit. And that circuit, for example, might detect whether or not a certain chemical pathogen is present and might release some sort of a drug that tries to mitigate the effects of that pathogen, as an example. So you can imagine in the future being able to do your design for things like medicines and other health and ecosystem applications in a biological substrate. So instead of designing an electric circuit that does that, right, design a biological circuit that does that. And so it's a quite exciting area, but also one in which a lot of the principles of control systems will have to be extended. The systems are much more noisy, they require much different types of robustness, and so it's a very interesting one for looking at those things. And finally, in the area of materials and processing, now, when you look at something like an Intel chip, right, and you think, how does that get built? There's an enormous amount of manufacturing knowledge that goes into building that well. And again, you see control systems all over, maintaining the temperature, maintaining the density of different chemicals, maintaining etch rates and other things. And what's happening is that we're now getting to where we can sense dynamically in real time lots more about the manufacturing process and use that to produce higher density, better purity, different types of structural materials. This is an example from a former graduate student, Martha Gallivan, who's now at Georgia Tech. And Martha was working on looking at control of the growth of thin films. So this is a simulation of a semiconductor thin film and the growth, and you get what's called island growth in these situations, and you'd like to control the rate at which islands grow and the rate at which islands merge, and those affect the superconducting properties, in this particular case, of this material. And so we can look at how to grow materials as a control problem and what we want to regulate when we do that. Okay, so as I say, this report talks a little bit about some of these different areas and some of the different things that are going on. And so if you have interest in how control applies and what the future looks like in these areas, please take a look. All right, so let me end then by talking about a couple of other things. The first one is I just want to talk about the kind of sequence of courses that go along with what you're starting to take now. And so CDS 101 and 110 are classes that are the first course that we offer at Caltech in control systems, and in particular CDS 110 will go through some of the detailed descriptions of what's called classical control as well as state space control concepts. We actually do them in the opposite order, so we start with what we'll learn next week is called state space control, and then we go into frequency domain, which is what's normally called classical control. And what it's trying to do in 110A is to provide all of you with the knowledge to work with control engineers, right, in a team setting. So what I hope is that when you get out of this class, right, if a control engineer stood up and said, yes, this system's going to work and it's going to be stable, it's going to be robust, that you would be able to say, ah, but what's the phase margin for your system and is that enough, right? That you would know what questions to ask that person and how to interpret their answers coming back. You might not be able to design the system on your own to handle all of the complications, but you would understand what the design elements were and what you should ask. So that 110 is designed to give you that information and to allow you, of course, to design simple control systems. In CDS 110B, we really talk much more about the detailed design tools for control systems. And so we'll talk about state estimation, we'll talk about robust control, we'll talk about trajectory generation and optimal control, and really here we're going to focus on the synthesis of control laws. So here in 101-110, we look at feedback systems and control systems that exist and how you might analyze them and a little bit about how you design them. Here the focus is completely on design. And there is, as I already mentioned, an optional course project in this, so if you're interested in what does it take to go from some of the types of mathematical theory and simulations and modeling tools in MATLAB that we're doing to something that actually runs on a real robot or on a real chemical process control system or on a real electrical or information system or an operating system or a web server control, that's what we can do through the course project. And I haven't decided the details on how to do those things yet, but I'm hoping that we'll have a selection of projects for people with different backgrounds to do. So that course is offered in the winter, same time slot, all of those things. Beyond these two courses, there are a number of other courses that are offered. I'll mention one specific one because it happens to be offered in the third term, and it's a good one to take that follows on if you haven't already had it, and that's CDS 104. So CDS is Control and Dynamical Systems. We're obviously talking about the control half. CDS 104 is an introduction to the dynamical systems half of CDS. And you should think of it a little bit like CDS 101, where in CDS 101 we're trying to introduce the basic principles and tools in control. In CDS 104, we're trying to introduce the basic principles and tools in dynamical systems. And there is a course, CDS 140, that's the 110 equivalent, right, which is much more analytical detail on that. And CDS 140 is a two-term course offered in first and second term. But these courses fit nicely together, 110A, 110B, and 104. And so for those of you who get an interest in this particular subject area, there are some courses that you can take. If you do take those courses, you're partway on your way to a minor in CDS. And so if you're an undergraduate, then CDS 140AB and CDS 104 or CDS 140A plus a senior thesis either in your own option or CDS 90 will get you a undergraduate minor in control and analytical systems. Goes on your diploma. If you're a graduate student, then if you take 54 units in CDS, which would usually be CDS 140AB, CDS 110AB, CDS 140AB, and two electives chosen out of the other CDS classes, then you can get a graduate minor in CDS. So for those of you who are interested, you can come talk to me at whatever point. You can sign up as a CDS minor, I think, any time up until a couple of months before you graduate, and they'll probably do it. I think they like it sort of 6 months before you graduate, at least. Okay, so that's a little bit about 110. The sequence of what comes after 110. All right, the next thing I want to talk about is the honor system, but before I jump into that, because it's a really different topic, questions about control systems and big picture and things like that, or CDS 101 and 110? Okay, all right, so I want to spend just the last 5 minutes or so talking about the honor system. So hopefully all of you who are Caltech students, and some of you aren't, some of you are visitors, but certainly I hope all of the Caltech students by now, even if you're just getting here as a first-year graduate student, know what the honor code is, and it's very simple. No member of the Caltech community shall take unfair advantage of any other member of the Caltech community. And I was a Caltech undergraduate. I've been a faculty member here for 17, 18 years, something like that, and to me, the honor system is one of the things that makes this place very special. And so I'd like to take just a couple of minutes to talk to you about it, because it only works because the students make it work. The faculty, as I'll mention, we reap the benefits of it, but we don't actually control it or implement it. It's really up to you. So why is the honor system important? Well, For one thing, and it's sort of obvious, it provides a framework for ethical conduct in an academic setting. If you're a scientist, this is sort of what it's about. You don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't do things so that you can scoop someone else, right, by screwing up their experiments or any of those other things. And so, really, it's important to learn how to do that because it's not necessarily natural. Many of us are very competitive, right? We want to be the first, we want to do things, and sometimes you sort of skirt some of the rules to do that, or you don't do things as carefully, and the honor system helps provide a framework to learn how to do things right and how to do things properly. It's also extremely important when you're in a community of scholars. You have to be able to talk to people about what you're doing and trust that they will give you proper recognition for what you've done, that if they make use of your results, that they will properly attribute those results. And we see this even through the homeworks, right? It's a full collaboration policy on the homeworks, and I encourage you to talk to each other. But of course, I expect that what you write down is your understanding of what's going on, not your friend's understanding of what's going on that kind of understands it better than you. Because otherwise, how can I fairly assess your performance in the class? And it's not fair to the other students in the class if you're not doing that. And so if you're going to be in an environment in which you work together to learn and educate, then of course it's very important that something like the honor system be in place. And I think one of the really important things is that it just simply allows much more academic freedom in the way that we deal with things. It's okay if I talk to you about the very latest research results that are going on, or I show you how I thought through this problem and did things. I'm not worried about that being something where I can't trust you with that information. And it goes beyond even just some of the academic things. It means that many of you, if you do a project, for example, in 110B, you'll have free access to my lab and computers and other things, and I trust that you will use those with the respect that they deserve. All right, how does it apply specifically to this class? So as I've already mentioned, the homework is full collaboration, but you should write up your own results. I want to know what you understand about the homework, right? How you get that understanding, I'm very happy if you get that by talking to people, talking to TAs, talking to me, reading other books, all of those things. But in the end, what I want you to write down is, here's what I understand about how to do this problem. It means that in this class I can give take-home tests, they can be limited time tests, open book, and I don't have to worry about that. I can say that what I want you to do is to demonstrate to me what you really understand by solving these problems on the exam, and not just having to go through and memorize everything and be able to do it from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Wednesday, the first day of finals, in this room all spread out, right? You can take the test when you want to take it, you can use the books that you want to use in order to understand that, subject to the various things that I allow you to use. And I was a Caltech undergraduate here, and sort of got used to this style. I went to Berkeley for my PhD. And there were two big shocks when I went to Berkeley. One was that I was a TA for a lab class, and so about a week before we had to go into the lab class. And so we walk into the laboratory, it was an EE lab, and every single piece of equipment, every functioner, every oscilloscope was locked to the tables, right, with a chain. And, naive Richard, right, sort of I go, geez, why is everything locked to the table, right? And the other TAs who'd been at Berkeley for a while said, well, of course it's locked to the table, right? People would steal it if we didn't lock it to the table, right? Didn't occur to me, right? I mean, my EE lab, there was a bunch of equipment over here. You would go get the oscilloscope you want and put it over on the bench, right, and sort of do the experiment you're going to do. Never occurred to me that somebody would walk away with that oscilloscope. Or if they did, they'd leave a note and said, I borrowed this for ditch day, I'll bring it back, right, whatever it was. And that was fine, right? And so that worked. So that was one. The other was that I took a computer science class, and because I was an electrical engineering major, it was a computer science class for both undergraduates and non-major graduate students. There were a lot of undergraduates in class, so just like this, a mixed class. And so we went to take the midterm. Midterm was at a scheduled time. It was 3 hours. I kind of expected that. It's a big place. You have to schedule things in order to get everything in. What I didn't expect was that we showed up in this huge lecture hall, and they said, okay, everybody sit with two seats in between them, nobody behind each other's in the rows, and the TAs walked up and down the rows, right, for the entire 3 hours, making sure that nobody's cheating. Right? It was just incredible, right, to me, right, that would sort of happen. But of course, very normal, I guess, universities, but not this one. All right? And the reason not this one is because the honor system not only allows us not to have to do that, but it doesn't even allow me to create a situation, right, in which I show that much disrespect for you as students. Right? I'm not allowed to proctor the exams those way. Even if I wanted to, right, I can't do that. And that's the sort of two-way street of the honor system. The other thing about the honor system is, as you hopefully all know, it is student-run, not faculty-run. So when, and this happens from time to time, we think that there might be an honor system violation, it looks like a couple of homework sets are too close, or somebody did something on an exam that, clearly they were following something. And this doesn't happen very often, but when it does, I don't say, all right, that's it. I want you in here. I want you to explain yourself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I simply let either the Board of Control or the Graduate Review Board know that here's something that I'm not quite sure about. Could they please look into it? And then your peers decide whether or not anything happened, right? If they determine that an honor system violation happened, they figure out how to nullify that advantage. And I have to say, as an instructor, especially after spending 5 years at Berkeley where cheating was, you know, a good reason to get thrown out, it's very weird to get back, student X should receive 0 points for problem number 2B on their final exam, right? Because, you know, at Berkeley, it was student X is failed. They're no longer at this university, right? They've been kicked out, right? Because they cheated on an exam. But that's not the way the honor system works. The honor system understands that sometimes people slip up, right? And it really just nullifies the advantage. And then separately, and it's a process that I don't get to see, there's a protection aspect of it where the Board of Control or the Graduate Review Board, if they don't trust that that person can come back into the community of scholars that we're in, they will take appropriate action to have that person not be at Caltech, right? But I don't see that as an instructor. So it's very interesting as an honor system. It works only if you guys make it work. It's very important to me as an instructor and as a faculty member here, and so I hope you will take the time to make it work. All right, questions on the honor code, how it applies to this class, why you're glad you're here instead of UC Berkeley. Okay. All right, so what we've talked about today is just a little bit more of some of the applications of control. I've gone through a little bit more detail. The detail is going to get a lot heavier very quickly, so starting on Monday, we're really going to start going into things. On Friday, in this room, there will be a MATLAB tutorial. If you haven't yet downloaded MATLAB onto whatever computer you use, please try to do that before the lecture so that you know that you can work it and so that you can go. Luis, do you want people to bring their laptops with them or anything if they have them? If you want to bring your laptops, so you can be following, Luis will be giving the MATLAB tutorial. And so if you want to bring in laptops so that you can start up MATLAB and do things, this room has wireless. I think there are plugs. There might even be Ethernet ports. So you're welcome to bring your laptop. Okay, see you on Friday.